is to take a seat. I'm going to be picking up from the Old Testament passage today, not verse by verse and line by line, but that story that Margaret brought us of Solomon asking for wisdom. And it comes, of course, after quite a few weeks where we've had this, well, account of David, the saga of what David went through and his legacy. And now we get to his son, Solomon. And it's a story that I think has something for us today. The nation of Israel is in a tough neighborhood. So at the moment, that's very evident. There was a time, 9th century BC, where it wasn't so tough. Basically, the major powers around, the Assyrians and the Egyptians, were having a bit of a quiet time, which left the space available for little kingdoms to flourish. Because when Egypt was strong or Assyria was strong, they just sort of marched across and overran all these minor nations. But this was a looking back, a lull in geopolitics. So the rise of Israel as a nation was in that space. And it's a huge story where the people of God got to a point where they thought, you know, we look around at how nations are organized and their states and they have kings and they have political classes and they have this and this and this. We want that too, and an economy. And that's the background to the story of Saul being made king, who, well, mixed record for Saul. Then came David. And David took the kingdom and it flourished. His own life was a bit of a checkered story, but by the time he died, he had peace on all borders. He'd extended the kingdom and things were going really well. He had established the people of Israel as a respectable nation, state, kingdom in that neighborhood. And his great ambition, of course, had been to build the temple. And I spoke some weeks ago about, you know, him bringing the Ark of the Covenant into his city to establish his capital for the nation. But his great dream was to build this temple, and he didn't get to do it. You know, the prophets made clear that God, no, this wasn't for him. It would be for his son. So David spent his life amassing building materials, trees from Lebanon, stone from here, so that the project was ready to go. So Solomon arrives today, and his father has died, and from among David's many descendants, Solomon is fingered as the one to be his successor. His mother had a role in this. She was ambitious for her boy. Mustn't forget, this is an ancient Near Eastern kingdom. And even though there's always a tension in Israel, they're a covenant people, they're God's people, and yet they have this tendency to think, well, the way the neighbors do it, we should take notice of that and have that as a model as well. And over the long term of Israel's history, this rises and falls. They're a nation, they're not a nation. And they change the way they operate. Well, in this case, effectively, David had a harem in modern terms. He had many descendants from various wives. And so upon his death, there was going to be a bit of a sort out as to which boy, and it would be a boy, would ascend his throne. And it's the son of his favorite wife, Bathsheba. And you know the backstory to that. So it's not exactly all squeaky clean. This isn't Sunday school ethics operating here. And that's the thing to note, that these people, they played life for keeps in a way that we don't. And the dynamics were raw and powerful. And they met God in and through that in ways that we would think, this is not on, this is not kosher. But that's the time, that's the people. So Solomon comes to the throne. Now, there was a practice among the Egyptian pharaohs that we know about, where when a pharaoh came to the throne, they'd spend a night or two sleeping in the temple, in their place of worship. Why? Because they wanted the blessing of their God on their reign. And so when you know that, oh, that's standard practice in Egypt, it's no surprise we read here, Solomon, upon coming to the throne, goes to the shrine and he sleeps there and he has a dream. That's the beauty of archaeology and ancient literature. You keep seeing things that you think were unique in the Bible, but then realize, ah, no, that was kind of standard practice. So Solomon goes to the shrine, not yet the temple, the place where God was pleased to be met, where Israel always sought God, where they went for guidance, and he has this dream. And you heard that this morning. Conversation with God. Solomon is feeling intimidated by what's coming his way. Okay, he's going to be king, but he's just a boy. We're not the only ones to suffer imposter syndrome at times. You know, how did I get here? And now I've actually got to live this, I've got to do this. He's feeling challenged, if not inadequate. He's sober to the responsibility and what's involved here. He's not just going to be a playboy and live it up. And there's that conversation. And he asks the Lord for what he most desires. The Lord asks him, what do you want? Wisdom. Wisdom. And that's really what I want to talk about today, is wisdom. We live in an information age, no shortage. We can get it within seconds. Information is not wisdom. And it's really obvious as we go into this century that the abundance of information actually creates headaches in itself. We saw this in COVID dramatically. Which information is reliable? Who can you listen to? One piece of data, and I may have mentioned it before, it came out of that, was that a survey of New Zealanders was 50% of New Zealanders got their information from friends and family, which is interesting. It goes on relational networks. They didn't go to the library or Google. Someone told them and they listened. That's how information got filtered and shared. It brings up the question, who do you listen to? Who do you listen to? Even just watching television channels, when a major news story breaks, I scan several channels. But who do I listen to? Who's reliable? The translation, wisdom, what we heard the word this morning, discerning, able to differentiate, having this insight to be able to listen to the voices and spot the truth. That's precious, isn't it? And it's all the more necessary because we're overloaded with information. We are getting very different stories and narratives at times. As soon as any issue gets charged, whether it's our election last year or just business as usual now, my goodness, or something as dramatic as Israel, Gaza, that whole situation, the ability to listen and have a sense that's true, no, that ain't, That's a porky. That's not true. That's wisdom. And my sense is we live in an age which doesn't really value wisdom. It just keeps piling on information as if that's going to solve things. One outworking of this, in my lifetime, the career structure in many professions and management in particular really changed. You know, it used to be, you know, 40 years gold watch and long-term, stable, proven capabilities. But in my lifetime, it's gone to more towards what do you know, education, qualifications, and such like. And what I've seen happen from about the 80s and 90s onwards is relatively young people being promoted very quickly in organizations. Okay, they've got the skills, they've got the skill set, they've got the qualifications, but what might not be there? But a gray hair, wisdom. And I think it just illustrates how we've lost a sense of value and vision for wisdom, which is, well, you don't sit and examine wisdom. You don't get a formal qualification. You can't buy it in a bottle. And traditional societies in the East, and particularly in Africa, and as we hear here, really valued it. So here's Solomon saying, who probably had access to all the information of the day. As we read the Old Testament, these guys weren't asleep. They knew the science and the politics and the economics of their time. Information flowed. But I need to know who to listen to. I need to be able to recognize the difference between what's true and what isn't. And in anticipation, you know, there's that classic story where it came to him that day, the two mothers claiming to have the same baby. Two voices. Who's telling the truth? Who isn't? How do I work this out? One of the titles for Jesus that is reflected in the New Testament and very, very rarely spoken about in our age, which I think is very telling, is that Jesus is the wisdom of God. And you hear it in Paul's writing, because the Greeks were into wisdom, and particularly secret wisdom. You know, some of us know, others don't. Gnosticism and that sort of thing. But Jesus is the wisdom of God. Jesus brings to us that freedom and that ability to recognize the truth and distinguish it from evil. So that's my way of lead up. So we have in the Bible wisdom literature. It's a whole category. So the book of Proverbs is particularly there. And sometimes the authorship is even accredited to Solomon. If it wasn't Solomon himself, it is his community. It is this culture of Israel and the ancient Near East. So to pick up one verse, if you're taking notes, but you know this. This is Proverbs 9, verse 10. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And I just treasure that verse because it encapsulates so much. The way I understand that is, if you're going to consider anything, you need to have foremost in your mind the greatest reality there is. God. How can you consider anything without reference to God? And yet, this is where it comes home. For the last two centuries in particular, Western culture has been on a secular adventure. And the whole purpose of the secular project is to construct a way of doing and being and living without God. So when you hear that word secular, that's the agenda. to operate without reference to God. The wisdom of the Bible is completely the opposite. No, you start with reference to the Lord. Because if you don't, you're missing the biggest reality, the biggest significant factor, to use that sort of clunky language, there is. The fear of the Lord, another proverb, is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. To be wise, you have to take God into account. And if I were to unpack that for secular people, because sometimes I don't have a conversation, don't rush them to talk about the love of God and Jesus. I sort of get there over time. But it's like, how can you be wise when you don't take into account the story of your own existence, the ground of your being? How can you be wise when you don't know where love comes from? How can you be wise when you don't have a sense of the purpose of existence or creation? And yet that is what our Western world is trying to do. And what is it? It becomes really boring. It just gets down to economics and politics and stuff that happens in this little box without reference to the depth of what it is to be, or a sense of the purpose of history, or an appreciation of how creation or anything like that. It's snuffed out. And that's deemed to be smart. Really? My Eastern friends, really raise an eyebrow at this. Because what we do to sort of cope in this, we say, well, I'm the center of existence. I'm a stunning individual. I'm an autonomous individual. And as long as me is the focus of attention, I can function. That's completely different from the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Now, fear is not a neurotic shaking of the bones or anything like that. Fear is due respect, due consideration. Have God in frame and take God seriously. That's what it means. It's not lose sleep over this and have nightmares or anything like that. The irony is, I'm suggesting, when we don't have God in frame, fear, neurosis, anxiety increases. Some of you may know this from family contact, but Barbara and I sort of became aware of this in the last two decades in Europe, where we had a lot of contact with teenagers. And the levels of self-harm and despair and suicide all rising. And a very clear process at work, in our view, because teenagers from age 10, 11, up to 20, were being required to totally construct and define themselves. In other words, take no notice of what you're told, or your family, or outside influences. You can choose yourself. In fact, you should choose yourself, who you are, and what you want to be. Now, that's the backstory to a lot of the gender confusion. And the teenage brain, we know from neurological study, just isn't capable of processing that, those sorts of momentous questions. And so it runs into crisis, tragic, tragic crisis. There are no givens. The individual has to decide everything. The wisdom here is the fear of the Lord. Start with God. But the secular project does diametrically the opposite, rules God out, and lays all the project, all the decision making on the adolescent. It's too much, can't cope with it. So that's the one thing that's happening around us. Rather than leading a generation to recognize and engage God and receive the assurance and the freedom that comes from that, youngsters are being told to stand alone, make their own choices, and that's just not wise. So there's a healthy fear of the Lord, which is taking God into account. And then there is bad fear, fear which is, neurotic. I'm struck by the fact that in this church we have some carving, an alpha and an omega. So it's a funny alpha. But that's a more convincing omega over there. The Greek alphabet. And in scripture, Jesus says, I am the Alpha and the Omega. And it's a way of saying, I'm the horizon. I'm the beginning and I'm the end. There's nothing outside me. I scan the whole of what is. Now, when we are calm and when we are relaxed, we're able to engage an open horizon. So, drawing a little bit on modern neural science and the sort of levels of the brain we have, when we're relaxed, we think well. When we're calm, that's when I do my blue sky thinking. You know, I can just engage things and things float and thoughts form, and it's a creative space. I don't know if it's like that for artists. If you need to be relaxed to come up with something. On the other hand, when we're anxious, when we're stressed, instead of having an alpha and omega horizon, we tend to focus in. And in terms of our brain, instead of being able to think broadly and widely and calmly, we might even go back to a fight-flight sort of function. Is this familiar, what I'm talking about? So I'm using these biblical words but referencing them to a bit of psychology. And so Jesus, whenever he meets people, invariably he's saying, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Now, I'm not putting this in Jesus' mouth or on his mind, but he understands that when we're afraid, our thinking gets very narrow and focused. And it's actually it's a very dynamic thing. It can save us and it can ruin us, this narrow thinking. And so Jesus is meeting people again and again and saying, don't be afraid. But it starts already in the Old Testament. Deuteronomy, there's a threat scene. And chapter 3, 22. Do not fear them, for it is the Lord your God who fights for you. So they're in a battle situation, and their heads potentially are just kind of freaked out by what they're seeing. And the message comes to them, don't be afraid. Don't. Alpha Omega. Keep your vision, keep your mind, keep your awareness open. Isaiah, similar message. Do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be afraid, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. I will help you. I will uphold you with my victorious right hand. Our tendency when we get anxious and pressed is just this focus, and we don't focus on God. We focus on whatever's scaring us, and it fills our horizon. Becomes huge. Whereas the wisdom that Solomon was seeking was a wisdom where was God referenced, that enabled him to distinguish truth from falsehood. And he could keep open because he had God as his focus. God was in the frame. I hope this is making sense. But it's so basic, and it's right through the scriptures. This debilitating power of fear to limit our vision and to drive us back to a fight or flight sort of mode of thinking. Now, the cool cucumbers, be it in church or government or geopolitics or whatever, are those who can keep the horizon open. Because the moment we get like a missile locked on to something or someone, we're not in our right mind. And even worse than that, we're open to manipulation, because there are lots of wicked, evil players who will manipulate the fear that is locked onto something or someone. The madness of crowds, mobs, all this stuff flows from here. So, bit of a potpourri. Jesus' words to us again and again, and all those people who came to him in all sorts of circumstances, was do not be afraid. Keep the Alpha and the Omega horizon wide open. Listen and watch for what the Lord your God is going to do. Then you're in a place to hear the wisdom of God, to be able to distinguish between what's true and what isn't. So Solomon started well, and then in the way of kings, it went to his head. So if you read somewhere along the line, he had 600 wives and all sorts of things going on. Success. He forgot this very wisdom. And in the next generation, the handover of the kingdom did not go well. But he started well. And I'd like to commend that wisdom and that idea of the Alpha and the Omega. Keep the horizon wide open with God filling it. And then we will be in our right mind. Shall we pray?